Muddy Knees Media.
This news just in, listeners. The Athletic is extending its £1 a month offer for all new subscribers, meaning you can get unrivaled analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, plus a brand new breaking news service and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts for just a quid. This deal won't last forever, though, so don't miss out. Sign up today at theathletic.com/totally.
Totally Football Show. Today, Premier League Round 5. Spurs West Ham like a Tory backbencher's wet dream. The threat of a good thrashing with Kane, followed by manual relief. Meanwhile, on Merseyside, Derby refereeing produces two Oliver twists and Pickford's big van removal. We examine the controversy and where it leaves the champions. Elsewhere, there's much more to discuss, so we'll be rounding up all the drama and looking ahead to the midweek action too as the Champions League gets underway in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Unbelievable. Monday, 19th of October. Listener, hello. Morning to you. What a time to be alive, eh? It's been a brilliant weekend of action. We've got top-notch European action on the way in the days to come. And Forest won a match as well. Huzzah. An hour as well, I'm delighted to say, coming up in the company of Daniel Storey of The Eye. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, James.
Michael Cox is also with us here from the world of brainy authordom.
Hi, James.
And it's a big welcome to Sasha Gurionov of Ocker Sports and having a real day job.
Hi, James.
Hi, Sasha. Wow, what a weekend. What do we have? 2-3-3s, a 2-2, 2-1-1s, and still no 0-0s, although we very, very nearly got one until that extremely late drama with Ross Barkley Sunday night at the King Power.
Still not as many goals as in Serie A. But
that's true, isn't it, Sasha?
34 in 8 games in Serie A.
Yeah, I mean, Serie A is just bonkers, though, isn't it? It's always been the case, though. Not everybody watched the game between Leicester and Villa because of, you know, the PPV and that. Daniel, you were across it, am I right?
Yeah. I mean, it was the worst game I've watched this weekend until that wasn't changed by Ross Barkley's late winner, but I guess that at least gives us a headline and puts Aston Villa as still, I think, the only 100% team in England, which is absolutely remarkable, not least because of the opposition they've played.
Yeah, only one other team in Europe, Daniel, has such a fine record, and it is Milan after their derby win. Villa now second place in the Premier League behind Everton, 1 point behind Everton, with Liverpool in third, West Ham are up in eighth, Leeds are ninth with the game in hand. There's loads of other teams we could talk about, but there's league tables for that if you want to do that kind of thing. Listeners, we've got a bunch of top football thinkers assembled here to analyse the weekend. Let's start off then with a match that really does take some explaining, and it's Sunday afternoon's Spurs West Ham.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Cresswell sends it in towards Rice. He couldn't get near it. Snodgrass was hoping it would drop. Lanzini! Oh, it's incredible! What a goal from Manuel Lanzini, and the most unlikely of comebacks from West Ham United.
Woof. All right, so West Ham 3-0 down, away to Tottenham with 8 minutes to go. Talk me through this one.
To be honest, it came out of nothing. It came out of one free kick. I don't think there was anything in that game suggesting that West Ham were capable of any sort of fight back. It felt like Bale came on maybe to score his first goal for Spurs. But I thought that West Ham were pretty much settled for a 3-0, and then they get a free kick. And there's a bit of panic in the Spurs back line, and yeah, just quite a spectacular defensive collapse, I thought. And even then, they should have won it. So, I'm just quite gobsmacked by how that turned around, to be honest.
Bale, who'd come on for what seemed like a very soft re-debut for his former club, came on, had the free kick, and then had a huge chance when it was 3-2 to make it 4-2. Even then, it still felt like a minor detail, a question of the scoreline. But instead, in the 94th minute, Manuel Lanzini with the last kick of the game, sparking pandemonium. It was just extraordinary.
Yeah, and West Ham are a bit like that. They seem to produce from 1 week and then don't seem to gain any momentum or suffer any negative momentum. but it felt like this was everything of them within the same game for once, because it wasn't just, I mean, Sasha's absolutely right, the goals did come from nothing, but there was such a marked change in them after half time. I think they got sort of four or five corners within 5 or 10 minutes of the restart, and Tottenham were coasting, but they were at least pushing, and it, you know, brilliant comeback, but it kind of begs the question of why they were so dismal in the first 15 minutes of the game, because had they defended properly in the, you know, in the first quarter of the match, they would have won it. I mean, it will infuriate Mourinho, of course it will, because it felt like, social media being social media, people were starting to think of Tottenham as title challengers in the first half, and then maybe proving in the last 10 minutes why they might not be.
It's not the first time it's happened either. You think back to the game with Newcastle, which ended with the point shared in similarly frustrated fashion. As you mentioned, social media getting busy with this. West Ham Bull, I think, was the hashtag that did the most business after this finish. But it is extraordinary. No team has ever been 3-0 down, 81 minutes played, and got something from the game, in the Premier League at least.
Yeah, it's not even a dangerous lead, is it? Three goals. The funny thing about this was it actually reminded me a lot of Mourinho's first game in charge, which was away at West Ham, where Tottenham went 3-0 up after, I think, about 50 minutes. That's 5-0 rather than 1-5 in this case. And it seemed like they had the game won and then were really hanging on at the end, and West Ham got it back to 3-2. The only thing really that was different was, of course, Lanzini's incredible shot. But yeah, it just seemed to me like Spurs kind of thought the game was won. And to a certain extent, I understand why they would feel like that, having been 3-0 up for the majority. But I thought it was interesting what David Moyes said after the game, where he very unusually said, I thought my side played really well in the first half when they're 3-0 down. And he said that, you know, sometimes the most difficult thing is when you're in that situation not to make any changes. And it's interesting that despite being 3-0 down, he didn't make a substitution until 77 minutes. Even then, I'd say more or less kind of straight swaps rather than, you know, chucking on two extra strikers. So, I mean, fair play to Moyes and West Ham for kind of trusting in the process and continuing what they were doing, because I think a lot of sides would have either stopped playing or tried to make such severe adjustments that they left themselves open to the counter-attack, which aside from that Bale chance at 3-2, I don't think they did.
Is there any substance to the notion that Bale's entrance, the substitution bringing Bale on, was one of the turning points of the game?
I don't think so. I don't think it contributed to the goals in any sort of way. I think it's two soft free kicks that Spurs gave away. I don't think it's really structurally it contributed to anything. If anything, you could say, you know, he was quite dangerous on the counter as with that chance. So, whilst it's easy to say, oh, yeah, look, Bale comes on and lose 3-0 lead, I don't really think that really changed much.
I think it was a direct correlation in that Bale will have to play another 24 matches again before he ends up on the winning side like the first time around.
Yes. We're kind of lost amongst all of this was the incredible beginning that Spurs had to the game, with a Heung-min Son opening the scoring a couple of minutes in, and Harry Kane with a phenomenal first half performance. Harry Kane, who of course is a slow starter to Premier League seasons and has been directly involved in 12 Premier League goals so far this campaign, 5 goals and 7 assists. Julian Laurent's tweeting, Harry Kane is England's best number 10 and England's best number 9.
Well, yeah, he's... I mean, the big question about Tottenham in terms of an attacking way was how they linked together midfield and attack that didn't just involve Heung-min Son having to pick the ball up deep and run 20 or 30 yards. They lost their chance creator in Christian Eriksen, and it was how they would recreate that. And it does seem like Harry Kane might be that chance creator. He has always been brilliant at picking a pass, either first or second touch, whether it's flicking it round the corner. He has an incredible knowledge of where players are going to be for that oncoming run. But now he's playing this sort of, almost like a little sort of quarterback role, where he can pick out passes. The pass for the first goal was brilliant, albeit aided by pretty rotten defending. And the crucial thing to say is that it doesn't seem to have affected his goal scoring. If anything, it's as if he says, well, I will do that and I'll do it well, but I don't want this to take away from my goal scoring, so I'm going to try extra hard to keep getting the shots away. So, yeah, it all looked rosy in that regard.
As I say, there were echoes of the draw with Newcastle here. So how do you think this leaves Spurs? How worried should Jose Mourinho be, Michael?
Well, he was fairly pragmatic after the game. Kind of said that's football, that kind of thing can happen, and I kind of get what he means. I mean, I think another day that Kane shot from range goes in, or Bale scores the goal on the counter attack. Certainly, some of the defending late on was pretty poor, and Spurs do seem to have a habit of set piece concessions, which is not very like a Mourinho side. But overall, I mean, I think there were quite a lot of positives in the game for Spurs. It just so happens they were all within the first 15 minutes. Mm-hmm.
I also thought the third goal was quite, like, looked really good, because this was when Kane pushed on and Son dropped, and there was no one with Son because I think the West Ham defence wasn't sure what to do. So he dropped into that pocket of space, released Reguilón, and then obviously Kane attacks the back post. So I think the fact that Kane can do both roles and Son can do both roles, I think it makes it very difficult for defenders there.
Mm. Of course, it would have been a different result if Lloris had used his right hand. Right, okay. Well, it was a tremendously entertaining match to watch. So well done to both sides. Loads of other absolutely thrilling encounters this weekend. Lots of draws featuring late drama as well at Chelsea and at Everton. And indeed, Everton's clash with Liverpool is where we're heading next.
We know everyone thinks this season is going to be different, but at Paddy Power, we're staying positive, because isn't the new normal just the same old football? Avoid unnecessary journeys. That's Fulham's trip to Anfield off. Self-isolate. Some strikers do that very effectively already. You see? New normal, same old football. And that's why if one leg of your 4-plus-fold Acca lets you down, you get your money back as a free bet on all football matches and all markets. The Acca Cracker from Paddy Power.
Max free bet £10. Min odds 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive. Exclude shop bets. T's and C's apply. 18+BeGambleAware.org.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Pushes that one down the line to find Luca Dean. Who can he pick out here? There's the header, Calvert-Lewin, who else? It had to be! He's at it again! In a Merseyside derby this time!
Yep, 2-2 Saturday in league-leading Everton's derby clash with champions Liverpool. A game rich in drama and controversy. You had Salah's goal, Dominic Calvert-Lewin's leap, the disallowed winner. But I think we have to start with the events of the opening minutes. Pickford's foul on Van Dijk. Liverpool, of course, were already up 1-0 through Sadio Mane, and busy challenging again when Pickford storms out and clatters Virgil van Dijk. Sasha.
Just makes me really angry just thinking about it, to be honest. Also, Van Dijk today confirmed that he's torn his ACL. I'm not sure whether there's any more information on how much further knee damage there is. I mean, if it's just a torn ACL, he might be back for the end of the season. If there is more, I think he's out for the season. But I think, I mean, I'm not a great fan of Jordan Pickford. And I tend to sort of pick on his positional errors, you know, when he concedes goals or his lack of composure. But I think fundamentally what we saw here, and I know some Liverpool fans are going on Twitter about conspiracy theories, how Pickford did it and like it was intentional. It wasn't. I think what strikes me about Pickford is he's a goalkeeper who seems to play without any composure whatsoever. He's jumpy. He feels like his judgment is impaired. And what we saw, what happened with Van Dijk, it was just basically reckless. I think, you know, he saw Van Dijk coming through and he just completely lost all sense of where he was and what he was supposed to do. It was awful, the challenge on him. I mean, he basically scissored his knee. But it didn't surprise me because I think Pickford has this in him. And I think, you know, it seems to be part of his game at the moment. And it's not going to really take him anywhere if he carries on like this. I think he needs really to pull himself together. What we saw here was a certain part of his game that now became a danger to an opposition player, which is really, really unfortunate.
Beyond his performance, what about the role of both the two officials who were at VAR in Stockley Park, but also Michael Oliver, who was standing a couple of yards away from the incident?
Yeah, I have some sympathy with Oliver in that it looked as if, from the naked eye, as if Pickford was kind of spreading himself to make himself big for what he anticipated was going to be a shot from Van Dijk. He wasn't looking at the ball, so I'm guessing he didn't know where that was, and that's both a defence and a prosecution when you are diving into a challenge. But so I have some sympathy for Oliver, partly because I think it was a tough decision to get right, and partly because he knows he has VAR to look at that as well, or should have had. And the reality is that VAR should have looked at not just the offside, but should have also looked at the challenge in isolation. And from all accounts, it failed to do so. That was a fault of the VAR officiating.
But see, that's the thing as well, that in the aftermath of the game, some sources are saying they haven't looked at the challenge. Other sources are saying they've looked at the challenge and decided it wasn't a red. So, I mean, there's a lot of confusion. I think no wonder that Liverpool are asking questions. But also, I think if you contrast it with what happens late in the game with Richarlison, you know, Oliver sees the Richarlison challenge straight away and he straight away goes for a red. And, you know, there is a wait where VAR review it. I mean, I think I agree with Alan Shearer on Match of the Day on Saturday night, where he said, look, you know, they're finding these offsides, but they cannot see this, that this challenge is awful, which I have to completely agree with, because it is something I don't quite understand how that could have happened. It's almost, I mean, I can understand how they might focus on a particular issue so much, but then I can't believe that they just forget about the rest of the incident. And this is the thing which I really have a big problem with, that Pickford committed this challenge and walked away from it with no punishment at all.
Yeah, and how much difference does that make, do you think, to what happened in the game, given that he makes a couple of key saves in each half? And you could make the case, and it has been made, that Everton's two goals might not have happened, certainly one of them, when they're still adjusting from his absence. They're still kind of working out their defensive assignments with him suddenly off the field, that his absence has a large bearing in Everton's two goals. You're not having that, Daniel.
Well, no, I mean, yes, it might have done, but those sort of ifs and buts happen in every incident where a player.
This is quite big, though, with the keeper who's behind the injury staying on and being absolutely key in a couple of Liverpool chances.
Yeah, but I mean, Robin Olsen's their backup goalkeeper, and he is a good goalkeeper. So we don't know what would have happened if Robin Olsen would have come on. Just as we don't know anything. I mean, the reality is that the decision was wrong. I don't think it's. Well, you're right, but I just don't think it's particularly helpful to think, right, well, maybe this did this and did this. And I think that kind of thing is what has fueled the sort of farcical kind of social media memes of, you know, Liverpool fans saying, well, we should be awarded 2 points. And this is just nonsense. Of course it's nonsense. It's football. It happens. It's really frustrating, but it happens.
We'll save that for a flip reverse with Duncan in years to come.
Yeah, maybe.
I would also add another thing. I mean, people are saying that Pickford had a good game, and he did. But yet at the end of the game, the mistakes that he makes crept in, because he shanks the clearance, which leads to the red. And also, if the Henderson goal stands, he should be saving that shot. So
right.
I think you could say that Pickford's game was perhaps as erratic as it usually is, except this time he got away with it.
Okay, so now you mentioned the Henderson goal. What would have been the winner for Liverpool that was disallowed? If you were angry about the Van Dijk absence of a red card for that challenge, what colour did your face turn when that goal was called back?
To be honest, the thing that makes me angry the most about the game is the Van Dijk challenge.
Right.
Like I think it completely trumps this disallowed goal at the end, because
okay,
the implication of the Van Dijk challenge is beyond the 2 points, is much beyond this game. It's now we're going to have an impact of it for the rest of the season. And I think Liverpool also perhaps have to play now several weeks without Alisson, without Van Dijk. And these were the key, you know, these were the cornerstones of their successes over the last two seasons. I mean, Van Dijk plays every game. This is a good point that Klopp made after the game. If Van Dijk had to come off, it must have been really bad, because he plays through pain. He doesn't come off. I think the last time he came off in the league game was 2 years ago against Southampton. I think he started, like, I think it's 93 consecutive league games. He's absolutely vital to this. So it will be really curious to see how Liverpool come back from this, I think. I mean, they have a game against Ajax coming up. Ajax just scored 5 goals. I mean, what does this do to defensive organisation? Perhaps the midfield is going to have to be more conservative than it is at the moment. So I think there would have to be changes in the Liverpool game to compensate for this.
I insist that we talk about the Liverpool's disallowed winner, Michael.
I think it's the most marginal VAR offside I've seen. I mean, I've watched the clip so many times and I can't tell if he's offside. I think it's increased. I mean, I know we discussed many times last season about the issue with frame rate and being sure whether a player's offside, but I actually think it's become even more complex now, because the change to the handball law means that the line is now not drawn from the shoulder, which is quite an obvious thing to see, and is instead drawn from a point somewhere between the shoulder and the elbow, which to me seems highly debatable. So, look, I know it's a technical point, but when there's millimetres in it, and that seems to be the case here, I'm just finding it slightly difficult to believe that this is 100% right. Okay, you have to make the best guess, but it was another game where I came away from it kind of wishing that VAR wasn't in football, to be honest.
Well, you say make the best guess, but in the absence of any certainty, wasn't this even something that FIFA and IFAB had stipulated, that in the absence of certainty, the goal should have stood?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the issue then is difficult to say what margin you can be certain and what you can't. I think then you get into other grey areas. But yeah, certainly. I mean, I think Liverpool have written to the Premier League asking for an explanation about what part of Mane's body was offside. And I'm not sure that was the intention when VAR was brought in to kind of clear up any controversy about refereeing decisions.
We touched on the things that made you angry or disgruntled, Sasha. Which bits made you really, really happy in this game? Salah's goal?
Salah's goal, one, because I think he's worked on some technique over the summer, because it is the same sort of volley without basically moving that he scored against Leeds, he scored against Villa, and now against Everton. There's certainly some technique going on there. But the other thing that really stood out for me was Thiago. I mean, you could see from this game that Liverpool's midfield definitely has changed. Liverpool's midfield, he's really good at passing the ball now. His disguised passes with which he created two chances in the second half were amazing, because literally it turns his body.
Firmino-esque.
Yeah, well, perhaps, but he opens up his body. The whole everybody thinks is going to go to the right-hand side. Yet he played in, I think, Salah, and he slightly overhit it to Firmino. And the ball to Mane at the end, after he was clattered by Richarlison, was absolutely brilliant. I think, and also you can see he's talking, he's completely involved in the game. It's obviously he's a player who comes in with lots of experience, winning experience, lots of skill, lots of confidence. And he's straight into that Liverpool midfield. It's straight into a system which is not very easy to pick up. So he's obviously very bright, very smart now. We'll see how long Liverpool will lose him for now. But certainly once he returns, I think this is perhaps where Liverpool are going to have to compensate for Van Dijk's absence. Maybe they're just going to have to start outscoring opposition again.
Yeah, I mean, one of the Thiago thing is obviously a double punishment for Liverpool, because one of the reasons they didn't sign a central defender this summer is that they did sign a central midfielder, and therefore they thought that, or Jurgen Klopp thought that Fabinho could slot into that back line and become another centre back, even after leaving Lovren and Herver. If Thiago is going to be out for a period of time, then Fabinho might well be needed in midfield, which punishes them twice, as I say, because they lose him as a potential defensive option.
But I quite like the balance with Fabinho in midfield, Fabinho, Thiago, Henderson. I thought it was, you know, it was a very well-balanced midfield, because, I mean, the guys knew what everyone else was. I think Fabinho did a reasonable job of covering the defence. I think this is the interesting thing as well. It's, you know, Everton top of the league. But, you know, Liverpool dominated this game. This is, I have to agree with Klopp after the game with this. I think also, you know, Liverpool find space quite well. They really passed it around Everton early doors, and I think it knocked Everton's confidence a bit. And I thought that pocket of space almost in the diamond, in the middle of a diamond of defenders that Mane found at early doors, they found it later and later. And this was precisely in this space that Henderson found himself in. So they clearly did their homework. So I think in terms of football, if I were Klopp, I'd be really pleased. I mean, as a fan, I was worried how they're going to come back from 7-2. And, you know, I didn't see any signs of that here. I thought it was a very confident performance.
From Everton's point of view, Dominic Calvert-Lewin continuing his brilliant start to the season. James looking comfortable again. Any other thoughts?
I think James Rodriguez has been the best player in the Premier League so far. I thought he was sensational again. Everton, I agree with what Sasha said. I think they were outplayed for the majority, particularly in midfield. But, I mean, every time James got the ball on the right flank, he created something. He was involved in both the goals, one from set piece, one for playing that ball into Digne for the cross. He created that chance for Richarlison where his head hit the post. He played in Calvert-Lewin in behind for a good shot. I mean, almost every time he gets the ball, he seems to be able to create a chance. And I think Everton were outplayed here, and for a couple of reasons, pretty lucky to come away with a point. But for them to be top of the league after five games and 3 points clear of Liverpool, it's been a fantastic start. So, yeah, I don't think we should be too down on them, because, you know, they haven't really covered themselves in glory in Merseyside derbies recently. And while they didn't win this, I still think they will, take some positive signs from it.
The other thing for Everton is that the resilience they've shown twice this season. You know, they conceded first against West Brom, conceded first against Liverpool, and took 4 points from those two games. Over the last 2 years, the most they've taken in a season when conceding first is 7 points in a season. So they've been criminally bad at reacting to that adversity. So to have kind of changed that and almost matched that in the first 5 weeks of the season is something that will really please Ancelotti.
Hey listener, when it comes to football know-how, listening to us three times a week means you should be at the very top of your game. Like Kevin De Bruyne, you can see the play before it happens. So isn't it time that you made some extra coin from all of this?
Football Index is the way to capitalise on your knowledge of all things on and off the field. Buy shares in the players you think will perform and win dividends when they make an impact on the pitch or in the media. Download Football Index on iOS and Android today, and when you enter the offer code TFS20, you'll get a 7-day, £500 money-back guarantee. Full terms and conditions are available at trade.footballindex.co.uk/moneybackguarantee. It's 18 plus only, and please be gambleaware.org. Become a football stock market trader today with Football Index.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
The rest of the Saturday action, well, pay-per-view customers certainly got some goals for their hard-earned money. Chelsea Saints ending 3-3. And then in the late one, we had another five goals as Newcastle got done by Man United 4-1. Possibly the biggest statistic here, though, comes from NUFC Fans Food Bank, who says, we're proud to announce that you have donated £16,000 from the Charity Not PPV campaign. People urged to give money to local food banks as opposed to splashing out for this game. This game was 1-1 in something of an echo of what we were saying with Spurs before, but it was 1-1 with 5 minutes of normal time remaining. It ended up 4-1. What happened?
Well, I mean, Newcastle's luck eventually gave out. They've conceding shots at an almost record-breaking rate so far this season. And last season, they're defensive by design, but they're not actually very good at defending. They allowed a lot of shots last season, and Martin Dubravka was easily their best player. And this season, Cardalo has easily been their best player. But at some point, if you allow opponents to have 28 shots in the match, which they did against Manchester United, those opponents will eventually score.
29 I've got, so it's even worse than you say.
It's going up all the time, James.
Yeah. A great result for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, though, after, of course, the disastrous defeat to Spurs, but also the rumours that had followed in the over the international break about discontent, lack of faith among the squad, grumbling from the likes of Fernandes, it is said. But the changes he made here as well, bringing Mata in to kind of partner Fernandes in the midfield, seemed particularly effective.
I thought Mata was really good, actually, and it was nice to see because I just think he's a wonderful player. And I think it was nice as well that he was so prominent in some of Manchester United's counter-attacking moves because, I mean, this is going back a few years now, but, I mean, his career really, not ended, but maybe his career as a really, really top player kind of ended when Mourinho judged that he wasn't really good enough for playing on the counter-attack at Chelsea because he'd been sensational in his first 2 years in the Premier League. And I don't think his career's ever really hit those heights. Yeah, some of his combination play with Fernandes, who was, again, fantastic, was really, really good. And we saw, I mean, United are very good when they're allowed to counter-attack. And the goal that they scored, the second goal from Fernandes, was absolutely sensational. I mean, a really, really good move. And then I think, you know, obviously Newcastle were piling forward in the closing stages and United could pounce on the break. So, yeah, there were some decent signs here. And yeah, it's something to be said as well for the, you know, the mentality of the side, considering that early goal. I mean, after such a heavy defeat last time out, I think they were the better side and maybe epitomised by Harry Maguire, who scored the equaliser after a difficult time for him and actually could have had another one with Jonjo Shelvey heading it off the line. So, yeah, positive signs for United.
Nice one. Next up, they've got Paris Saint-Germain away. That's on Tuesday, followed by Chelsea, then RB Leipzig, who are top of the Bundesliga right now, then Arsenal, then Istanbul Basaksehir, and then Everton. Crikey. And all of that is coming up in the next 3 weeks. Is this season crazy or what? We're going to be talking about the Paris Saint-Germain fixture coming up on Tuesday a little bit later on in this show with Julien Laurence. But speaking of Chelsea, as we mentioned, they were also involved on Saturday. 3-3 draw with Saints. Once again, Chelsea very much a team of two halves.
Would it be too simplistic to think of this game as Timo Werner playing against a high line? Timo Werner taking on Bednarek, whose number he obviously had, especially after he turned in for the first goal. Also, perhaps Southampton not being as tight in midfield as they could be. Perhaps Jorginho dropping deep and, you know, sending that long ball over the top. But you saw when Southampton's press did work, they knocked out Havertz and scored a goal immediately. So perhaps, I don't know, I was looking at this game thinking, yeah, Werner could run away from the backline. Once he gets a bit of speed, you know, it's very hard to defend against him. And I think, for me, this is sort of pretty much what happened in the first half, that perhaps Southampton weren't tight enough in the midfield, and that was that high line that they couldn't quite protect against a very fast forward.
seems fair, Sasha. I did want to talk a little bit about the extraordinary defensive numbers that Frank Lampard continues to compile there, conceding 1.5 goals per game under him since he took over. That's the worst record of any permanent Chelsea manager in the division. And the thing that to simple folk like me seems strange is that this is a team with Jorginho, but also with N'Golo Kante there in midfield. So why are they so desperately bad? I know Kepa was back here, but it wasn't all his fault.
No, not entirely his fault, although I do think, I mean, the second goal, he didn't cover himself in glory. And even the first one, I thought he was rounded particularly easily by Danny Ings. Yeah, I mean, there just seem to be quite a lot of individual mistakes. I mean, none of their centre-backs have ever really installed themselves as a solid first choice. We saw Christensen make a really bad error against Liverpool that basically cost them the game. We saw Zouma make a really bad mistake here with a back pass that got Kepa in trouble. I just don't really trust any of their defenders. Even Thiago Silva, who came in, obviously made that mistake against West Brom. So, look, there's some organisational problems, but I think there's also some individuals who probably, you know, need to take responsibility for their own mistakes. But yeah, I mean, it just completely summed up Chelsea for me. They're very exciting going forward. I thought the third goal that Havertz scored was brilliant combination play by Pulisic and Werner down the right. But yeah, defensive, I mean, it's just the same thing all the time, isn't it? That just sums up Chelsea for me and is the reason really why I can't really see them going for the title as some people suggested at the start of the season.
I wonder if there's it's slightly speculative, but I wonder if there's a little bit of, it would sit somewhere between naivety and arrogance, I suppose. But Lampard after the game was saying, you know, it's disappointing for us to concede three goals and to not beat a team like Southampton. And I sort of think, well, he hasn't beaten Southampton at home yet as a manager in three goes. And I just wonder if it's almost as if he thinks, I've got these attacking players, I've got these technical midfielders, we should roll over these teams. That's what I expect, because I remember being Frank Lampard Chelsea midfielder when we rolled over teams. And it's not that easy anymore. You know, if you've got a manager like Ralf Hasenhüttl, who is, you know, has a better CV than Lampard, who has a better tactical coach than Lampard, then if you leave flaws there for him to exploit, he's going to exploit them, especially when they're the same flaws that were happening all the way through last season. So it almost feels like he needs to take his medicine a bit and think, well, let's go back to basics here. You know, we're not going to win games if we're allowing a team like Southampton to have more shots than us, to have more shots on target than us, to create more chances than us, even when we've got this excellent array of attacking players. It just feels a bit dim, really.
Yeah, Seb Stafford-Bloor tweeting, if Frank Lampard had a different passport, some bright spark would be proposing getting Sam Allardyce in for a few days a week by now.
I suppose getting Sam Allardyce in, I do think they need to get a different keeper in because he just seems to suck
the life.
Well, yeah, but who was injured for this? But I think for everybody's sake, I think I said it last time at the Liverpool game, you know, this has to be the end of Kepa, because there were situations in that game where you look at the body language and Zouma is like, Kepa is just looks completely beat. Yes, he made some saves.
What noise would you make for Theo Walcott, meanwhile, returning to Saints and setting up that stoppage time equaliser for Yannick Vestergaard?
Yay. Oh, I don't know. I don't know what noise to make for that. I think he probably made it himself by shouting lots afterwards. But again, that disorganised defending. And then Vestergaard is huge and he somehow got forgotten right in the middle of the box. And Kepa was nowhere near the header. I know he probably wouldn't have saved it. But it's the whole mentality of defending. I mean, as you were saying about Lampard before, I have as Daniel was saying, about this, all these attackers. Does he really not understand defending, basically? I mean, because this is what happens when you look at this Chelsea team.
Well, credit to Theo and Southampton for their stirring late comeback. Chelsea next up will be facing Sevilla on Tuesday. Sevilla, who lost this weekend in the Liga 1-0 to Granada.
Spent half the game playing with 10 men as well.
Interesting. We'll have more details on that from Alvaro Romeo in Tuesday's Euro-flavoured totally. Finally, just to wrap up the rest of Saturday's action, it consists of Man City taking on Arsenal, a 1-0 victory for City, which saw them back on track after two disappointing results. Saw Arsenal back on track too, in terms of losing away at a big six rival, like, you know, very much on brand. 29 such games they've had without a victory. Of course, is it fair to say this game wasn't quite the thrill fest that many of us were hoping for? Michael, though, you had fun trying to work out what shape was everyone in and why William was now a centre forward and Sterling a holding midfielder and things.
I really love this game, actually. I must say, much as some of these goal fests have been very exciting, after a while, I kind of, you become a bit immune to the excitement of them, I thought. This was just a completely different style of game. But yeah, I thought fascinating. And I think, you know, we often give Guardiola criticism for overthinking his tactics. Well, I thought this was a great example of where he probably sprung a surprise upon Arteta, of course, who knows him better than anyone. The use of Kyle Walker as a right-sided centre-back, I thought, completely nullified Aubameyang. I think the use of João Cancelo in an unusual kind of half right-back, half central midfield role probably produced the best performance I've seen from him. And I thought it was very different from the way they played against Leeds, where the wide players were always coming inside to shoot, and I thought City were as predictable as I can remember them. Here they played with great width. I mean, Foden out on the left, I think had a really good game and you know, got the better of Bellerin in the build-up to the goal. And Mahrez, I thought, was City's best player against Kieran Tierney, who's a really good defender. I thought everything about Mahrez's game, his dribbling, his pass in the build-up to that goal was really good. And just, yeah, interesting things all over the pitch. Sterling used as number 10. Not sure I've seen him used there before for City, although he has played there for Liverpool and England previously. I just thought it was a good quality game, and I think City deserve credit as well for the way that they killed the game after half-time, which is something that I don't think they've done as well as we would have expected under Guardiola. I think often they've invited too much pressure. But Arsenal just didn't have a shot. I think their last open play attempt was 20 seconds into the second half with a Pepe header. After that, they had two free kicks from Luiz and Pepe, which were nowhere near the target. And City were pretty comfortable. So, yeah, I thought it was a pretty enjoyable game and a good City performance.
I picked out Kyle Walker as the game's best player, or maybe the difference maker, because he, as Michael says, he's picked as that right-sided central defender, but his role was, when City didn't have the ball, was basically to sprint wherever he needed to go in City's half to intercept or to head out a ball that basically stopped a one-on-one with either Aubameyang or Pepe getting through. And Walker has his criticisms, and rightly so, I think, and he can get a bit flat-footed and allow runners in behind him. But I really like that combination of him and Cancelo being able to do each other's jobs if they need to, and Walker with that ridiculous recovery pace. He's bad at some things, but there aren't many better defenders in the world at that recovery pace to snuff out danger.
All of that, plus Sergio Aguero back way ahead of schedule. Any thoughts on his performance, including or not including his convivial arm around Sean Massey's neck?
Yeah, I mean, that was really disappointing. Really, really disappointing. It was really disappointing that Guardiola used his defence as, well, he's a nice guy, so we can't have done anything wrong, as if nice guys don't make mistakes. And very, very briefly, the reason why it makes a difference that it was Sean Massey-Ellis rather than a male official is that, well, firstly, Sean Massey knows only too well that how female officials or females in football can be victimised and, mistreated by people in the game after the Richard Keys and Andy Gray incident. And it's also just it's incredibly patronising of Aguero. It was a stupid thing to do, and I'm really surprised that Guardiola didn't just say, yeah, you know, it wasn't a good thing to do, I've had a quiet word with him, it won't happen again, because that would have been the easier and cleverer response.
Certainly. All right, well, Man City will be at home to Porto on Wednesday, while Arsenal travel to Austria for some Thursday night action at the home of Rapid Vienna. Next up for us, listener, we travel to the heady delights of Sunday's other games. Goals from Sheffield United, Fulham, Palace and Brighton, and yes, Villa.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Hey, listener. 19th of October today, I think we mentioned that. In 1993, on this day, Norwich beat Bayern Munich away at the Olympic Stadium in Munich.
Fed in by Newman, and Robin's well forward, and Goss was well forward too, and Norwich have taken the lead. Jeremy Goss again. Unbelievable stuff. Well, when he scores goals, they're either spectacular or important, and that one's both.
They were the first English side ever to do this. Not sure how many other English. How many English sides have beaten Bayern Munich away since? Anyway, they got a draw back home at Carrow Road and went into the third round. I'm hearing two from producer Charlie. So they're one of only three teams to do it. Anyway, they knocked Bayern Munich out of the UEFA Cup and they got done by Inter Milan. At San Siro, a game which I remember with great affection because I watched it sat next to the great Nicola Berti. Woohoo! If you're listening to this, by the way, not on the 19th of October, but on 20th, Tuesday, then on this day in history, 20th of October 1928, Leicester had their highest ever Football League score. It was 10-0 over Portsmouth at Filbert Street. Arthur Chandler with six goals in a win which became known as the Six Swans match. Why is that, James? Well, after Chandler had scored five goals, five swans flew over Filbert Street. A sixth swan flew over shortly afterwards, and then the fans demanded a sixth goal from Chandler, which he duly scored. Marvellous stuff. I mean, it's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah. Chandler, eh? Could he be any more prolific? Incredible.
So, also on this Sunday then, we touched on Villa's remarkable finale away at Leicester. At the other end of the table and at the other end of the day, the bottom two met at Bramall Lane. Sheffield United with a 1-1 draw with Fulham, which featured a fabulous goal by Adamola Lookman. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, he was the game's best player as well. I'm really pleased for him because he until Sunday, he'd started 15 league games since his move from Charlton to Everton, which was January 2017. And clearly that's nowhere near enough football for a then 18, 19-year-old and now a 22-year-old. So if he can get the regular minutes that his development needs, he is a special talent. He really is. He's probably made some bad decisions, but he's also got a bit unlucky because he's gone to clubs that have then changed managers and he's not fitted in. And hopefully now, albeit at a club threatened with relegation, he can kind of demand the ball and look to run the show, which is pretty much what he did.
Mm. 1-1 as well between Palace and Brighton in the Glenn Murray Classico. Another late goal here, a deflected 89th minute equaliser from Alexis McAllister. It's his first. Hello, Sasha.
Sorry, can I slag off the Fulham goalkeeper again?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So I thought there's some worrying things here in the Sheffield United game for Fulham. So against a team that can't really score, I thought Fulham were pretty much torn apart time after time in the first half. And of course, at the very, very end, they again have a PSG number two who can't deal with crosses because that penalty doesn't happen if Ariol doesn't drop the ball, having collided with his own defender. And I just thought there was just not enough competence again at the back for Fulham. And I know Lookman has at least added something to them going forward, but at the back, they still, I think, are pretty ropey.
Michael, a quick thought on events at Selhurst Park?
Yeah, disappointing game. I think if you didn't see this game, I'd say imagine what you think might have happened between Hodgson's Palace and Potter's Brighton. That being that Palace had one shot in the entire game, which was from a penalty, and Brighton had about 20 shots, dominated possession for the majority, and very much deserved their late-ish equaliser. But yeah, it was a disappointing game. It was the kind of game that I think you'd usually look forward to because it's, you know, a bit of a derby. The A23 derby, not the M23 derby, I believe, as pedants insist on calling it. But I just thought without fans, it kind of lacks atmosphere. It was actually a little bit scrappy. There was a few kind of squabbles and a late red card for Lewis Dunk with a kind of Pickford-esque tackle. But yeah, and not a particularly interesting game, to be honest.
All right, then. And the late game, Leicester-Villa, as we mentioned, finishing 1-0 to Villa after Ross Barkley's late, late strike. Villa continuing their perfect start. Midlands team that narrowly avoids relegation one season, off to a flyer the next one, doesn't have European commitments. I think we all know where this is going, Sasha.
Yeah, I think this was a game where I think Leicester were acutely aware of what sort of threat Villa can pose. So Tielemans very much next to Mendy, centre-backs deep. And I thought they had a very sort of tight game plan whereby they wouldn't overcommit. And I thought they closed down the space in midfield really, really well, as opposed to what Liverpool did a couple of weeks ago. So I thought it was a very cautious approach from Leicester, which didn't make for a particularly interesting game.
I mean, the finale was nice, but yeah, before that, it was almost as if we'd had all the fun and it was going to be hard for them to live up, to match the extraordinary events in North London a little bit earlier that day. Monday, we've got two more Premier League games to conclude round five of the season. West Brom take on Burnley at 5:30. Burnley, of course, the only pointless team remaining in the Premier League. Leeds, meantime, at 8 o'clock, will be hosting Wolves, which could be an exciting match. We'll have more on those games in Thursday's pod. Very shortly today, Julien Laurent will be joining us, as I mentioned earlier, to muse over Tuesday's Paris Saint-Germain Man United clash in Paris. Before that, though, let's get some odds from Lee Price.
Hello, listener. Yes, you. Have I ever told you how much I appreciate you? No? Well, I do. Many don't stick for me, I know that, but you're a good one. Or you just can't be asked to press skip, but whatever. Let's not spoil the moment. Anyway, I am a man of fragile ego, and to be honest with you, I long assumed the position in this segment was to bury the commercial partner, to hide away the bloke shouting the odds, literally, and to pretend it wasn't happening. But my eyes and my heart have been opened, listener. Actually, the Totally Football Show clearly have been treating this slot like a Manuel Lanzini fizzle popper. That's my new word. Just trying it out. I think it works. I'm the bolt from the blue, the show-stopping end. So thank you. Thank you all. As for the numbers, I suppose I better say some. Burnley are pointless, take that how you will, and we don't expect that to change after their Monday night fixture with West Brom, who are the 7-5 favourites to win that one. Everton top the league and are 17-1 now to win the title. They're 3-1 to finish in the top four, while the rest of the Premier League continues to be glorious, brilliant viewing. Good enough, dare I say it, to pay to watch. Just kidding, honest, hey, call off the mob. Ta-ra.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It is over 18s only. Terms and conditions do apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Listener, what's coming up this week from your friends at Totally? Well, Totally Football League show on Monday, which will no doubt concern itself with Paul Scholes getting off to a losing start at Salford. Daniel, you're chuckling.
No, the thing that made me laugh about that is how Gary Neville has been incredibly insistent that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer needs patience and time to turn things around at Manchester United, but did sack a manager who was unbeaten so far that season to replace him with a mate who then lost his first game. I mean, these things can happen, but it forced a wry smile, shall I say.
I see. Meanwhile, I imagine there were smiles too for you as Chris Hughton got off to a winning start at Nottingham Forest.
Yes. I will not talk about Nottingham Forest unless Matt Davies-Adams is on the show to save the listeners. So, okay. Yes, first win, which is good. Suddenly the fixture list looks a little easier.
More details on that and much, much more in the Totally Football League show from Monday. On Tuesday, three shows for you. There's the Offside Rule WSL edition, which will probably have a bundle on Vivian Miedemar, who's now the top scorer in WSL history. 52 goals in 50 games. Totally Scottish Football Show. We'll talk about the Old Firm game and that. Rangers winning to stay top of the Premiership. And also on Tuesday, up very early in the morning, it's the Totally Football Show European edition, which I think I've mentioned once or twice. Loads in this one. Milan derby news, Napoli COVID controversy latest, Spain's Big Two losing, and of course, that thorough look ahead to matchday one of the Champions League. Speaking of which, hello, Julien Laurent joins us now for a quick heads up on Tuesday night's clash between Paris Saint-Germain and Man United. Hello, Julien.
Hi, James. Hi, everyone.
Jules, I imagine that Paris Saint-Germain have been looking forward to this since the draw, a chance to get their revenge for that big surprise knockout in the last 16 a couple of seasons back by Man United.
You're right, Jimbo. Exactly. That's the first thought that everybody had, really, when the draw was made. Not that he would have the same importance and impact, of course, because when United came to the Parc des Princes 18 months ago and won 3-1 and knocked PSG out, that was in the knockout stages. Obviously, the last 16, it was another remontada, another psychological disaster, in a way, after PSG was so brilliant in the first leg at Old Trafford and won 2-0, could have easily won by more as well. So certainly there will be a sense of revenge a bit, or at least a sense of, you know, let's let's get one back on United, especially after what happened in 2019, because as we said, it won't have the same impact. Even if PSG finish top, for example, and Leipzig second and United go third and are out of the Champions League, I don't think PSG will see that as a revenge as such, because it was obviously far more of a trauma for PSG to be knocked out the way they did by United 18 months ago than it would be for United just to finish third of the group or fourth.
Beyond any kind of backstory, though, each of these games are now really important for both teams because it's such a tough group they're in, with Leipzig, top of the Bundesliga, in this group as well, as alongside Basaksehir. And having now gone all the way to the final a couple of months ago in the Champions League, are PSG really putting everything towards Champions League this time around?
Yeah, I think it, once again, it's the big objective and the big target. And I think there's a feeling inside the club for sure that they will try to build on last season's campaign. They had an interesting summer in terms of recruitment. They could not sell as much as they wanted, but certainly in terms of the players that they bought for the money that they had available, you could say it's more than a decent summer, really, more than a decent recruitment. So far, players like Florenzi, Moise Kean had his debut on Friday night. I thought he did well. He didn't score, but could have scored and created some chances for himself, as well as being interesting in his link-up play. I thought that was good. Rafinha had a really strong debut, played an hour in midfield, was really good, gave a wonderful assist for Kylian Mbappe on the first goal. So there's been some positives, but you're right. That's what, once again, Thomas Tuchel will be judged on, is the Champions League. It looks like they have a new status in a way, and they have to confirm that status by doing hopefully as well or even better than last season. But certainly, you know, be there with the contenders when we come down to the quarterfinals, maybe semifinal and etc. And there's a feeling that there's a lot of excitement, I think, in Paris at the club and with the fans that the Champions League is back again, not that long after that defeat in the final, but certainly that it looks PSG could do something interesting. And you're right, it's a tricky group a bit, because I think Basaksehir would be really the fourth team in the group. And I think maybe it would be down to how well you do against the Turkish side, because I think Leipzig and United and PSG are PSG's life everywhere, but they're quite, you know, quite on the same level, more or less, especially for Leipzig and PSG. So it'd be very interesting to see, especially United, and how well they do in the group stage.
Mm. How well do you think they're going to do on Tuesday? What are the prospects they have there at the Parc des Princes against PSG, who I imagine are heavy favourites for this?
Yeah, I would say a heavy favourite, especially at the Parc des Princes, even with very little fans. The thing is, and it's a bit like it was 18 months ago, PSG would play exactly the style of football that United want. And we saw it a bit, in fairness, against Newcastle on Saturday night as well, when they scored three of their four goals on the counter-attack, pretty much, United. And it would be exactly the same. PSG would have loved the ball, which means that Bruno Fernandes and Marcus Rashford and whoever else plays, if Pogba plays or Martial is back, will have a lot of space to play on the counter-attack.
Or Cavani.
Or even Cavani, you're right. I'd be surprised to see him start, although, you know, nothing surprises you in football anymore, because he hasn't trained much really with the first team, and he just came out today on Sunday when we record this out of his quarantine. So it'd be very interesting to see what Solskjaer does with Cavani, but yeah, maybe even Cavani. But all that space, and it's exactly what United love. They really love going forward quickly, having quick forward transitions and play on the break, play on the counter with all that pace they have up front. And I think PSG will offer and that. I think it would be a question of who will take more of the chances, because PSG will have a lot of chances as well. We know that the form that Mbappe and Neymar are in is pretty incredible. So they will have chances, but they will also probably expose themselves a bit and give some chances to United too.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jules. Well, listen, we'll hear more from you and we'll discuss this more on Tuesday in the Totally Football Show's European edition. And of course, we'll enjoy the game together in Tuesday night's goal show on BT Sport. For now, though, merci, mon ami, et bonsoir.
Merci.
Well, many thanks to Julien de Rome. More from him, of course, in Tuesday's show. 3-1, of course, for the Red Devils last time they visited the Parc des Princes, which wasn't that the win that got Oli the job permanently? It was. Do you agree with Julien's optimistic view of United's prospects this time?
Yeah, I do. I think they'll play on the counter-attack, as they did very well last time. The strange thing last time was that they played on the counter-attack throughout the game, and yet it was held up as an example of why Solskjaer gets the club, because he has the side playing dominant attacking football, which wasn't the case. But yeah, United have generally been good in situations like that, and I think this is probably one of the more interesting games of the round.
Mm. Well, you can decide for yourself when we list some of the other key games, and there's some pretty interesting ones in Tuesday's show with Alvaro, Jules, Rafa and James Horncastle. That's it for today's show, though. So many thanks to Michael, Daniel and Sasha. Lovely to see you all. And thanks you, listener, for your company. Have a great week and we'll catch up with you soon. Cheerio.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.